Rise and shine! It's a great day in the North Woods!
Welcome to the Camp Voyager podcast. I'm your host, Alex Quanley, and today we're joined by Doug Merriman. Doug was a camper and staff member in the 70s and is well known in the Camp Voyager community for his wilderness expeditions and for building and racing custom canoes. Here is my conversation with Doug. To start things off, how did you hear about Camp Voyager and how long were you there?
Well, I had a good friend of mine that lived down the street growing up, Bill Dexheimer. And his brother was a counselor at camp. Now, his brother was a track star at Ball State University. And they were on their way to a track meet in, I think it was Duluth. And he and like two or three other guys in a car. And I think they picked up a hitchhiker. And the hitchhiker either knew of camp or had been at camp and something they were talking about. And you know, since he was in physical education stuff there in college, he thought, well, maybe in sports, he thought, man, maybe this would be good. So he went to camp and became a counselor in 1970. So that year he came back home to Fort Atkinson, which is Wisconsin, which is where I'm from. And nobody else from camp was from that area. So, and he knew that, you know, I liked to canoe because we lived right on the river. And so they only lived five houses down the street. And he came down and showed my parents and I, you know, slides from camp. And the next summer, I got sent there for a couple of reasons, because my parents were actually going to be going away on vacation. And it happened to be at the time when it was right during the transition between the first 4 weeks and the second 4 weeks. So they were thinking it was only going to be a four-week stay, but because of the timing when they were going to be gone, they decided to send me for all eight. And but they thought it was going to be a one-time deal. And I came back enjoying it so much that they sent me back another year. So I was there 2 years as a camper, 71, 72, then a dishwasher, 73, truck driver in 74, counselor in 75 after my first year of college. And then 76 was my first big canoe expedition, which is with five other guys from camp. We all kind of grew up there at the same interval of that early 70s. And we took off from Moose Lake and paddled up to the main part of Hudson Bay, up into Winnesk to Polar Bear Provincial Park. And so that was my last, well, that so 75 was the last year I was at camp. 76 was with these. Then 79, they did another big trip with guys from camp and just kind of kept on going with other canoe adventures after that.
I'd like to come back to the expedition stories. We're going to get to that. But first, I'd like to hear what about camp made you keep coming back? And you're still coming back. I just saw you this spring or early summer. You were on your way up north. But so what makes you keep coming back to camp back then and now?
Well, I guess a lot of it is, you know, there's a nice camaraderie with people that you're just dealing with each other. I mean, you don't, in today's world, you have all these other obstacles in your way. You have camps for about any kind of interest around, but, there was something really fun about the simplicity of camp and the activities that they were around. Of course, the canoe tripping was kind of the ultimate for me. And I know just that sense of adventure of the canoe tripping was always a big draw for me. You know, the W.A. Fisher Book of Maps, and they have them up on the mess hall wall. I took mine, and we got that the first year that we were at camp, and I took mine and pasted them all up, every one of them. So it kind of even reached the corner of my room. And every year when I went up there, I came back and I was tracing my routes that I did on there. And I always wanted to expand those lines into new areas. You know, I didn't mind crossing some of them to get to new areas, but I didn't want to do the same routes year after year. You know, I always wanted to see what's beyond And that's kind of what eventually took me on to bigger trips in other places. But just that sense of adventure that I had at camp. And, you know, when you're a kid, kids often have that sense of adventure, and you want to kind of nurture that sense of adventure when they're young so that they kind of keep that spirit alive in them, because you get distracted so much with so many other things as you get older. But to keep that sense of adventure and what's out there, and that intrigue, and you know, the physical testing that challenges that they bring, and it's physical and mental challenges that they bring. There's something that's it's kind of got a unique draw to it, and I think it's a great way to experience some of those challenges as kids through that camaraderie of going on a trip together, tackling things, and you get done and you think, wow, hey, we really did something, you know? Like that big feeling you get, like when you first cross Grand Portage, you know, it's like this thing that you hear about, but then when you do it, it's like, you know, at first it sounds almost formidable, but you get done doing it and you think, hey, you know, we did it. And you know, you it's a sense of accomplishment and self pride and pride in the others that you did this with. And so it's that kind of nurturing of adventure within yourself is really kind of unique.
And I think in a lot of ways that sense of adventure is suppressed in kids and adults these days.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, camp kind of helps you express that, and in many ways, I think that sense of adventure is kind of an innate feeling. It's natural, you know. All humans in the world sort of have that, but not all answer the call to it.
Mm-hmm. But also, you know, you're doing it with primitive means. So what it does is gets down to yourself. You know. Here you can think, well, oh, I need this to do that, or I need this to do that. But, you know, there you go out on a trip, and you've got just the basic fundamental things, and you have to solve issues, force yourself to move on when it's tough. It's just, there's this a different sense when you're confronting challenges with basically yourself and just the minimal elements that you need to get by with.
Yeah. You can't really hide behind, you know, a fancy car or a fancy job or anything. I mean, it's just you against the environment out there.
Oh, I'm not going to go out today. I'm just going to sit here and since I'm, you don't have that. I mean, you just have to.
Yeah, right. Because you have X amount of days of food planned, and you have X amount of miles across, and it's not moving that day is not an option sometimes.
Yep.
You talked about the canoe trips are kind of a lot of what brought you back to camp. And many people in the camp community kind of know you for your big expeditions to various parts of mostly, is it Northern Ontario?
A lot of Northern Ontario.
A lot of Northern Ontario. And so how did you progress from taking trips into the Boundary Waters, and I'm assuming eventually the Quetico, and then beyond?
Well, it kind of started with the seed being planted by counselors that they were there at camp. You know, my first year at camp, I had Tom Bowes as my counselor, and Tom had been to Hudson Bay and up on the Dubont River in Northwest Territories. And so he told us stories about his extended canoe trips, and you know, so the seed was planted there. And so as I grew up, you know, we grew up with a couple of guys that we all enjoyed this kind of thing and all had that kind of dream to go on and strike out on our own to do our own trips. And the Hudson Bay trip had already been done by several people from camp. Tom Bowes had gone, Paul Keller and Dick Crane and Jay Moore, Dick Crane, you know, a number of the guys. Well, Dick Crane was a counselor my first year there too. And they had all done trips. And so the original Albany River trip was always kind of enticing, but I wanted to do something more than just that because it had already been done. And I remember getting this one book that I had called Wild Rivers of North America. And I was going through it and I found the Wenisque River up in Northern Ontario. And so it was, and that just sounded really appealing because it ends up in the subarctic tundra. And it empties out into Hudson Bay, denning grounds with a polar bear, and has beluga whales out there. So it's just like something even kind of beyond what the original people groups that did the Albany River trip. And there again, it's kind of like going back to camp where I always wanted to trace new routes and see new territory. And I wanted to kind of extend the limits where camp had gone and do something different. You know, not just go where some of the other campers had gone. Now, the first part of the route up to Lake St. Joe from Ely was still the same. It's quite a difficult trek up there because there's a lot of small waters in between where you have to do a lot of portaging and going up little creeks that don't have water, and it's tough going up there. And then you get up to the north and you start hitting some of the bigger river systems that drain into different ways into Hudson Bay. So once we got to Lake St. Joe, and then the water all goes east out the Albany River to James Bay. But we continued north up over a couple other heights of land into the Toscan River system and then into the Attawapiskat and then up into the Wenisque River. And so it was kind of, again, that extension of going further than some of the people had gone before and seeing something new and different and coming back and being able to share that. And that's kind of a neat thing to come back and say, yeah, well, we got to see something that's different than campers before. It's not like it's a big ego thing, but it's just kind of like, you know, it's a pride in a new challenge that hadn't been taken before, striking out into new territory.
And from Ely to Hudson Bay, is it around 1,100 miles, 1,200 miles?
Yeah, about 1,100 miles, a little over 1,100 miles. And it was 51 days, but you have to remember there's a lot of days in there where you're walking, hopping rocks, going up little creeks that have no water in, and going places that, you know, you can't even paddle. So there's a lot of that. I think there were 9 heights of land that we had to cross over from different river systems.
Can you explain what a height of land is?
Well, a height of land is the high point that divides river systems. So as you're going from one river system to another, you have to go upstream and keep on going up. And of course, at the top end of any river system, any river starts off as a spring or a little creek or something that has almost no water in it. And then you have to cross from that side over to the other side and start getting your canoe into places where there's enough water to get going downstream again. So many of these places require long portages and difficult treks where it's not easy to paddle on the upstream side or the downstream side until you get enough water further on down the watersheds to where you can actually float a canoe and actually navigate and paddle. And of course, sometimes even going upstream, sometimes the current gets so strong if it's bigger water systems that it slows your progress. So it's a slow going, but that's okay. That kind of adds to the sense of accomplishment when you get done. It's like, well, there's a reason why people don't travel to these areas, and that's because it's tough. It takes a lot of work, takes a lot of caring. But on the other hand, you know, the accomplishment when you get done is greater because you've done something that people generally don't do. And you know, so it was a long trek, like I say, 51 days, 9 heights of land. And it was just a lot of variety. You know, we saw a lot of variety on that trip because you have the woodlands very much like what you see around the Quetico as you're going north through there, up through Lake St. Joe, and even a little bit north. But then you start getting onto bigger rivers. And then as you get onto the top end, you start and going down the Winnisquee River, the trees are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and to where you're in this subarctic tundra where it's mostly scrub brush and very small trees and very different terrain. And you're dropping off the Canadian Shield, which is the old base rock of the mountain range that used to be bigger than the Rockies, apparently, that was wiped out by glaciers. And that's the rocky outcropping that we know there at Ely and through the Quetico. And you're dropping off of that in waterfalls, and you get to where there's none of that rock left. And you get into limestone from old ocean bed, and limestone that can be 50, 70 feet tall on the sides of the river going up. So, you know, you start seeing some unique landforms and some real neat transitions in the environment as you paddle through. And that's just sense of intrigue. What's around the corner next? I mean, what are we going to see next? And that's kind of that lure that camp always had with the canoe trips, is like, you know, what's around the corner? What's in that next lake? What are these next falls like? I mean, it's kind of a lure. If you get kind of stuck into that, drawn into that magnetism, it's like, it just keeps propelling you further.
Mm-hmm. What attracted you to Hudson Bay specifically?
Well, initially that trip was just because, well, it was a unique thing to be able to leave from camp area. We left from Moose Lake, not from camp. Some trips did leave from camp. So it was a way to go from our known environment into new unknown territory. But also going further north, like I say, it was going into kind of a new sense of an area that we hadn't gone to, we hadn't touched in camp. So you had to just get yourself prepared physically, equipment-wise, and tackle, figure out all the things you needed to tackle that. You know, back in those days, too, it's harder to plan those kinds of trips because, you know, now with the internet and things like that, and the multitude of people that go different places, even if they just fly in or whatever. But in those days, it was very difficult because there wasn't much information out there about some of these places. And you had to just figure out ways to make it work.
Mm-hmm. And Hudson Bay is part of the Arctic Ocean, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And of course, paddling through there, we ran through a couple of First Nation villages. And, you know, you go through these places on a nice summer day. They were welcoming, at all the places, they were welcoming of us. And especially the fact that, I think one of the things that always helped in that is the fact that we had paddled so far to get there, that we weren't just the typical tourists that they would see. And tourism to them was limited to a very select few that would come in for guided fishing or hunting trip, something like that. But they would see us, and they knew that, you know, we could handle ourselves traveling through the lands, and we'd gone places that, in many cases, they hadn't done. So there's kind of a mutual sense of respect for each other in the fact that they respected our abilities out there. But I wanted, at that point, I also wanted to go back and learn more about the people, because, you know, you go through a land and it's an intriguing land and landscape, but that's only part of the story, because there are people that are there that are part of that landscape for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Who knows how long it is? I mean, they've been there for a long time. And so that kind of intrigued me again to take me back to those places to learn more about the people and their place in the land.
And you ended up living with them.
I lived with them for a year. And I wanted to spend at least a year because I wanted to experience all of the season changes. Because, you know, for you and I, you know, wintertime, yeah, we close the door and turn up the thermostat, stuff like that. But for them, it's a very different, it brought around a lot of different changes in their lives through the seasons, as they would do more fishing this summer and more hunting in the fall and winter and trapping for furs and things like that. And it was just it would bring a lot of changes in their life from different seasons of the year. And, you know, I wanted to kind of experience the whole seasonal change. And also these people, it's amazing that even in my lifetime, they have gone through such drastic changes, because when I was a kid, people my age, they were still living out in the land, just in a log cabin off somewhere in the land. And it wasn't until into the 60s, in many cases, that these people were brought in off the land to live in reservations. So I have, I ended up living with one family, and they had six kids in the family, two older than me and four younger than me.
How did you meet them? You just paddle in and say, hey, can I live with you?
Yeah, well, I paddled into through their village on the way to the one village that I was living at already. So I went into Webequay, which is an Ojibwe First Nations village on Winnisk Lake. And I went there because we had been through there. We had some good contacts there, and I kind of knew the landscape there. And so when I planned on going back up there, I thought, well, I want to go there, and I want to try to, you know, I had probably over ambitious. I thought, you know, it'd be great to go out, build a cabin and learn all this stuff. But, you know, there's not enough time and really to do all that kind of stuff. And it gets pretty hard. But, you know, I got to go up there and started off in Webequay. Well, I went in there in the wintertime. And just as in the summer, when we came paddling in, you know, there was that sense of that intrigue and respect, the fact that we knew how to handle ourselves out on land. Well, I didn't want to just land in there in the wintertime on an airplane, on skis, on the, you know, where they were flying in. So I came in by dog sled. It took me 5 days to get in by dog sled. But there again, that gave me that transition where I'm going through the land, navigating through the land on my own power, well, dog sleds, but my own intuitions and stuff like that. And in many cases, they didn't have dogs anymore. They just had snowmobiles at that time. So that brought a real sense of intrigue, and it puts you on a different sense of a different level with them, because they have a certain respect for that and interest in it too. But then in the springtime, when the ice was melting and the ice was going out of the lakes, I flew out from the village and I picked up my canoe and I paddled my canoe back into the village. And it was 270 miles in by canoe. And I just did that with my solo canoe. And I did that, well, I wanted to have my canoe to get around throughout the summer and fall. And on my way in, I stopped in this one other village. And I knew of a guy there that one of the teachers at the first village had told me about. So I met him and stuff. And then I arranged to go back there during the summer. So it was about 70 miles through lakes and rivers to get to their village from where I was living. So I paddled over there during the summer and spent a week or so there. I have no idea how long I spent there, but when I was over there, he said, why don't you come back in the fall and we can come with us out trapping? And so I said, yeah, that would sound great, because that was going to get me directly into a family's house, living conditions out in a remote village, a remote camp, separate from the village. And so that fall, I went back over there and we went out for a couple of months out onto a trap line. And this is living out in the bush in a little log cabin in their home ancestral lands, where they had their own trapping grounds. And all those families come from different areas around up there, and they kind of maintain their traditional grounds. Even if they're brought to a reservation that's 50 miles away, their home is still back where they initially grew up in through the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. And that's where their trapping lines were, and where they had their trapping grounds, and where they would live. And to this day, they still have remote camps where they travel to. Often they get flown out there to these remote camps, or in the wintertime by snowmobiles, they travel out to the camp, and they'll stay there for extended periods of time. It's not like the old days when I was there, but they'll go out for moose hunting. There's not so much trapping done anymore. It's because there's no fur market, but that was one of their livelihoods back in the day, was furs of beaver, mink, marten, otter, lynx, all of that. But the fur market really died out with fur protests. But that was a big part of their lives because it was a big part of their original culture. That's how they lived traditionally, was through the harvesting of animals off the land. And of course the furs and stuff would make their clothing and blankets and things like that. So it was, and then when the Hudson Bay Company and the Northwest Company, you know, the big fur trades came in, that brought in a sense of an exterior economy, that trading goods for furs were, that brought in new things to the native people. So it was always part of their traditional culture, even before the contact with the whites. And that was, today, the only part of that remains really is the hunting for food. Whereas moose, they don't really go after beaver or things like that so much anymore. Very few people do any kind of trapping. But still the hunting and fishing are still done as far as food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got to live out in the bush with his family, and it was grandpa, grandma, kids, grandkids, all out in two little log cabins, a tent, and a teepee out in the bush. It was a unique experience, you know. So I actually got to see kind of the tail end of the true woodland native people. And now they only go out and visit these camps occasionally, and they're not what they used to be, but they used to spend months out living in the bush. And like I say, the family that I was with, those kids were all born out in the bush. They just lived naturally out there. In fact, one of the family members, Moses, who was 4 years younger than me, he was one of my good friends. You know, he was 4 years younger than me, and he was born in the bush, and he was brought into the village at the age of about eight years old. Didn't see his first automobile till he was 19, when the Canadian the firefighters, I don't know what the terminology for the group is, but they were coming into the native village asking for people to sign up for firefighting duty. And he signed up. That was when he went out to fight fires at 19. This would have been 1978 or 79. That was the first time he ever saw an automobile. You know, and you think this kind of stuff happened a long time ago, but it didn't. It's pretty recent history. And to be able to have seen some of the last of that kind of living and people, didn't dawn on me as much then. I was just having adventure. You know, I was just out there for the adventure and to learn and experience and to soak up, you know, as much as I could. Now that I'm older, I look back on this and I see that was pretty unique thing that I was able to experience, kind of the last of a lifestyle and way of life. It's kind of sad in a way, because there's some really nice things about that. And they haven't had a really easy life. and I don't think there's a lot of drawbacks of the reservations today up there, but you know, some places are better than others as far as their adaptation, but if they still do a lot of their hunting. And those that embrace the woodland culture and still are out hunting doing stuff, they love it and they enjoy that. Not everybody does. It's a different life than what they grew up with, you know, in my lifetime.
You had talked about how Tom Bowes sort of planted these seeds for you about going on these expeditions. And in many ways, you've also done that as well for campers and counselors who have met you over the years. How do people go about getting started on planning a sort of expedition? And in this case, for expeditions, we, at least at camp, we say expeditions are at least 10 days in length, a trip at least 10 days. Your definition is maybe different, but where do people get started financially and logistically on planning that sort of thing?
Well, it is a difficult thing because it's a long period of time. And I mean, even though it may not have cost a lot back then, it still was a lot of money, you know, to do. So it took a lot of planning. In many cases, just talking or talking to some of the people that have done some of these, you kind of get a sense of what a big trip is and how to do it. Now, I didn't really consult with Tom or Paul Keller or any of these Paul Roberts too much on our first trip, maybe a little bit, but what we did is we just scouted every available resource. I mean, books, maps, everything that you could, writing letters even to different places, because we didn't have the internet back then. Today, you can zoom in on Google Earth and you can start mapping out and figuring out places to go and you have a lot more information at your fingertips. It was even time consuming, hard to get all the topographical maps for planning out of a trip back in those days, but you'd have to go to like US Canadian Map Service and get topo maps and figure out the distances and look at elevation changes between places and just trying to figure out what was possible. I remember my second big trip was going to Alaska, and that again was started through initially seeing a photograph in a National Geographic magazine about the Noatak River, and I had this picture of Mount Sukupak up on the headwaters of the Noatak River. I said, I'd like to go there. I just said, you know, you get that picture in your head and you think, well, you know, I really want to go there. So then you get it in the map and you look to see where it is. Well, I didn't want to just fly in and just go down the river. It's 10, 14 days down the river, or whatever. It's, you know, I'm just down. It's not as big a deal. Well, so we started trying to figure out some way to connect it into other places. Well, there's this mountain range between here and here. There's another river over here. If we can go on that one, but we had to come. We ended up stringing together a whole list of five major rivers, the Yukon, the Chandler, the Koyukuk, the Alatna, and then the Noatak. But there were two mountain ranges between those, and some of them, and 210 miles upstream on one and 160 miles going up on another. So we had to just get the maps out, look at the elevation changes and figure out what you can do. And just, we even got top aerial survey photographs of some of the detail in the mountain pass. Now, back in those days, we could only get 1 to 250,000 scale maps of any of that territory, which is not a terribly large scale topographical map. Today, you know, you can get much greater detail, but, you know, they didn't have all that highly detailed topographical maps back in those days. But that's what we navigated with, and we got used to navigating with those and did a pretty good job with it. I remember even taking my van off insurance and just walking to work every day and just saving all my money so that I could do that trip. I mean, you do what you have to do. I mean, it's, you know, I know I used to go around and I showed a slide program where I had three projectors with a computer control, dissolve control, and a soundtrack stuff with, and I used to show that to a lot of places. And unfortunately, that equipment doesn't work anymore, so I can't even go back and digitize it the way it used to be presented. But I used to get a lot of men come up to me and said, yeah, I always wanted to do a trip like that when I was your age, but I just never had the chance. Well, you know, you just kind of smile and, yeah, agree with them. But, you know, a lot of it's not having the chance, but it's making that opportunity happen. You have to really want to do it, and you have to be willing to give up and do things. I mean, it would have been much easier just to go from college into a job and, you know, off and that's it. But when you start taking big chunks of time away, I know Bob Sullivan delayed his job with an engineering job from University of Illinois when he graduated engineering. We all had our own things we had to give up to carve out several months to do this. And, you know, and that's at a time that's kind of a fundamental time in a lot of people's lives is, you know, coming out of college and, you know, where you're going to go. And, you know, you're not going into the workforce. So, taking time off and, you know, that's, I don't think people look at it quite the same way today, but I think a lot of times, you know, like, well, what did you do? Well, I took off to go on a camp trip. On the other hand, I think for somebody like Paul Roberts, I think he actually found that he got a positive scoring when he was going into school at Dartmouth because they started talking about this big canoe trip that he'd done in the Northwest Territories up on the Back River. And, you know, there is a sense of a lot of skills that are required to be able to plan and execute something like this. And a job employer may recognize that, but they may not. But it's a tough thing to have to take that kind of time off. And I think that trip costs each of us back at that time about $1,600. And this is 1979. And that was just the trip cost. There were still personal costs with all of that too. And that was a lot of money for us. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when I went to Canada to live with the Native people for a year, taking a whole year off to do something like that. To be honest, I mean, that's where my college student loan money went into that, really. and I saved up a bunch of money. But still, it cost me, I think, around $7,000 or something like that back in those days. Plus, I had some other money put in there. So it cost me probably a good $10,000, $12,000 back in those days to do that. Mm-hmm. And you look at today, you know, to go off and do something like that, yeah, it's going to take you a lot of money. Just flying in and out of a village up there. I didn't fly in too often, but I did fly out from the village up there when I went out to get my canoe. I flew out from Hudson Bay when I took my canoe out in the fall with my canoe. So, you know, there's always, and those things in today's world, it's going to cost you, you know, over $1,000 just for one flight. So you're going to start racking up two or three of those. You're going to get a couple $1,000 there. It's just everything adds up and it's expensive, especially up in the North Country where things are remote, everything's flown in, everything's expensive. You know, we had to do a lot of planning going across Alaska. We had gotten in touch with Alaskan guides, asking them details. They didn't really provide that much that helped us out. We did have to write ahead to these different villages where we're going so that we could fly provisions in to be held for us because we couldn't carry 80 days worth of provisions going across Alaska. So we took 40 days worth of provisions and we had another 40 days of provisions flown into Bettles. It's a little fly-in village up in the Brooks Range up in northern Alaska. And so we had to communicate with these people so that they knew in advance that we'd be shipping these things in and they would be held for us and when they would expect us to see us. You know, today, you know, you have communications while you're out there, but remember back then we didn't have that. So today I carry a GPS with messaging on it so I can message out and whatever. But, you know, we just had to pre-plan all that kind of activity and let them know exactly when we'd be in as close as we can, you know, a certain range. It just took a lot of preparation, just figuring out all the what ifs. And what if somebody got hurt? What if some, you know, all these different things that happened. And it's even hard to find information to fly our gear and stuff out. And it just takes a lot of time. And so it takes months of planning to do a trip. Even today, it still takes months to go through all the scenarios of what you need, require. Because once you get out these places, you're on your own, and you don't have anybody. I mean, we going across Alaska, other than three villages going across Alaska, 1,400 miles, two native villages and one kind of mixed village, and none of those, no road access anywhere on any of them. So you're kind of out there. You have to just really think ahead, plan out, plan for conditions, plan for different scenarios, and get yourself physically, mentally, and equipped to handle it.
For someone looking to do a trip like this, what kind of tips do you have for saving money for the trip? Because that's kind of one of the biggest barriers is the money. And then secondly, the time and the impact it may have on your career. So yeah. I guess we'll start with how did you save money, and then we'll transition to how did it impact your career in the long run?
Well, I'll tell you, going to Alaska, I mentioned I took my van off insurance. I parked it. I walked to work every day. I took my lunch to work. I got a second little nighttime job teaching at a small community art center. They had a gallery. So they actually gave me a place to live there in the gallery, the second floor of the gallery, just to kind of watch over the building. So I was kind of essentially kind of the artist in residence there. And I then across the river, they had another building over there where they taught classes. And I taught a photography class there. So I just did that just to and I walked over there, unless one of the students picked me up. I mean, I just did whatever I could, you know, to save money. And, you know, just taking your lunch to work and driving as little as possible, or like in my case where I didn't drive for a while. And when I went to the native village to live for a year, I sold my car. I bought a car for $1 for my sister. You know, it's just a junk vehicle. I put a little bit of money in it, got it running. And because I was going to be up in a northern climate with my car just sitting at this remote airstrip on the end of this long gravel road, nothing there. You know, you don't even want to have a good car there. So I just had a piece of junk car that got me there and got me back. Not easily. It was a sense of adventure. You're going anywhere with that, but... just did what I had to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. And how did these trips affect your career? And maybe briefly go over what your career was. You're now retired, but did you think it set you back in your career, or do you think it gave you an edge or an advantage?
Well, I think it certainly did change the course a bit. I mean, I went to photography school. So I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Photography. But then I went after my first 4 years of school, or after my first 2 years of school is when I did my trip to Hudson Bay. So then I came back 2 more years to get my Bachelor of Fine Arts. And then I went into grad school. I waited a year after college, after my BFA, worked, saved money, and did stuff preparing for Alaska. And I knew that I was going that year. So I couldn't really pick up a job where I was going to be a permanent job. I had to just kind of get something that could suffice. And I got a job running a wood shop in a sheltered workshop for handicapped people. And we had a full wood shop, and we manufactured wood products for industries, for businesses. And not just wood products, we also did, I set up and built assembly lines for all the electrical dashboards for a big cabin cruiser company. And we did their wiring harnesses and stuff like that. But it was a good job, a nice job, but it wasn't like a forever job. And it was something that I knew I wasn't going to be staying at. And then when I got back from Alaska, I went into grad school. And I was in grad school for a year and a half. And it was after grad school that I went to live with the native people. And I was going to go back into grad school after that, but the grad school kind of actually screwed me over a bit, because I went in with the understanding that I was going to do a work project in lieu of doing a thesis, which was going to be a photographic culmination of a photographic project about the Native people and this trip to Canada. And they were all for it and signed all this stuff beforehand. And then I got back after spending a year and, like I say, $10,000-$12,000 of money. And they said, no, you're going to have to do a written thesis instead. I just said, yeah, that's it. You know, because we had this agreement and I could probably take gone to court over it, but, you know, it wasn't worth it. I didn't want to do that. But during that time when I was in college, I started canoe racing and I was also custom building racing boats. So I just went back north and started building with my friend again and building canoes. And these were lightweight racing boats. So 18.5-foot canoe that was it. In those days, the first ones were maybe 22 to 26 pounds.
Wow.
18.5-foot canoes. And then solo canoes were shorter than that in those days. Now they're the same length, up to 18.5 feet. And today they're down to maybe 17.25 pounds and get into carbon and stuff. But then starting in the early 80s, we still didn't have carbon as a full building material, only as reinforcements because it was so prohibitively expensive back in those days. And I think it was about 82 or 83. It was our first all carbon boat. And I can buy carbon today for about a quarter to a fifth to a quarter of what I could back then. So back in that day, it was very expensive.
One of the rare commodities that's gotten cheaper over the years.
Yeah, because it wasn't produced for wide markets. It was just used in aerospace, very niche areas. And today, now you have it in tennis rackets, golf clubs, skis, everything. Oil pipes going down into the big drilling pipes. You know, they do carbon because they build them so much lighter than the other one. I mean, it's just used everywhere. Auto bodies and things like that. So it was something that was just on a very small niche production schedule back in those days. And it became, there was no market, very, very little market. So yeah, it did get a lot cheaper over the years. So anyways, I went back and I was, besides the canoes, I also did some commercial work, mostly in the paper industry, designing and building the ink reservoirs for the printing presses that did decorator colors on Scott towels, you know, Viva towels. You know, it was they all have printing on them, and I built all of the ink reservoirs for the big machines and stuff because they were having some real issues with the ones that came on the machine, and did a lot of different filtration tanks and things with, around the center, chemical tanks and stuff around the tank. Worked on their water. They had two dams with turbines and stuff. I did a lot of their turbine work, recoating those in ceramic filled epoxies and metal filled epoxies and streamlining and making them more efficient after cavitation of years of them being in use. Just did a lot of that and got into boats pretty heavily. And over the years, I built probably over 1,600 canoes.
Wow.
Because I was, back in the earlier days, we built more. Now, I didn't build 100% of that boat. I did the main layups and stuff, and then I had some people come in to help me with varnishing and things like that of the gunnels. Now, these days, they don't even use varnish on gunnels because they're all molded carbon fiber. But, earlier on, boats had less work in them, and as it got more and more details in them, it got to more and more hours per boat. So the numbers of boats would start dwindling and the cost was escalating. And during that time, I also started picking up into some race car parts for some local people who were doing stock car racing, stuff like that. We also had the Experimental Aircraft Association in Wisconsin. So I started building, working with some people building fuel tanks and things for the airplanes. And there's a lot of home building going on. And then eventually I left my shop burned down in 88, just right down to this much ash on a concrete floor. The concrete floor is no good anymore because of all the heat from everything just blew up and cracked and everything. It was just a disaster. And I struggled back with that for a couple of years. It was so underfunded, you know, getting back into it. Lost, you know, moles is something that took me years to, over years, building and building all that stuff. All gone and stuff like that. So I struggled back for a couple of years, and then I got a job running a composite shop for a jet manufacturer, doing a custom manufactured jets down in Florida. Little twin engine, 4 to 5 seater jets, all composite fuselage. It was exactly the same materials that was going into our racing kit. And I'd worked with those materials for years. So I had actually worked in those materials for 15 years. And, you know, so we were building a small composite fuselage jet. And unfortunately, that job didn't go anywhere. The owners were doing some shady business dealing. So I got out of that and came up to this area where I live now and got a job working, building prototypes for defense contracts. So it was defense research contracts. So we worked with a lot of Navy programs, missile defense, and things like that. And I worked with carbon fiber, Kevlar, and all those different composite materials, starting off with firewall bulkheads for Navy ships to prevent fire from spreading throughout the, you know, making firewalls that would stop the fire from spreading and stuff. And we got into ceramic fiber exhaust structures and carbon tooling for highly precision parts and stuff for military defense and missiles and stuff like that. And you can make more money doing that than you can building canoes. I mean, canoes is, yeah. You know, when you're people, even today, you know, trying to sell somebody a $5,000-$7,000 canoe is, there's a small market compared to aircraft or aerospace or defense contracting where they'll spend the money on that kind of
yeah.
because it has a unique advantage over previous stuff. Well, in the defense contracting, that world went really well for me, but you know, I came up back in the 70s when we started building this stuff in these racing canoes where we had to formulate all of our own resins because we didn't have all those materials available on the open marketplace. So we had to formulate our own resin systems with base resin systems and diluents and different modifiers and stuff like that. And we had to figure out a lot of the different process things on our own. But when I got into the R&D work, all that background of figuring out how to make things work together is really fundamental in the R&D market because you're taking different materials that have never been processed together and trying to figure out how to make that work. And, you know, I kind of grew up with that idea of that notion, how to work and trying to figure out how to make things work together in a product. And so I was doing things with co-processing of thermoplastics and thermal set resins and stuff like that that were new and unique, working with ceramic exhaust structures that were 15, 16 feet, you know, in size, that were weighed a couple hundred pounds, that were for Navy ships for to reduce heat signatures for incoming missiles and things like that. You know, things that were really unique, but that it's that sense of adaptability and creative ways of looking at how to use materials, and it was always there from the beginning. So it was kind of ingrained in that a creative side, you know, of process and process engineering, basically.
Yeah. So I tried refinishing a Kevlar canoe once, and that was a little overwhelming. I can't imagine all the experimentation you had to go through and the chemical mixtures and finding and
we had to do large carbon tooling. It would be precise down to a 4/1000th of an inch.
Wow.
And, you know, because you're talking about stuff that's very, very critical when you have to co-mold carbon in with titanium parts on missile structure, because you have expansions of these things under the heat process that they're subjected to during forming, which is generally 300, 350 degrees. And you have to have very careful matching of those parts and expansion of those parts as it goes through the process. And then as it cools back down, you know, being able to build that to a tolerance that's within the demands of the program. So it would put a lot of unique challenges, and then not all of them work out. Some of them work out really, really well. Some don't. But that's the nature of R&D, but it was enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like your big expeditions and adventures were sort of during your college years in the summers.
Yeah.
In between schools. And then I know recently you've done a few since you've retired. And it doesn't sound to me like that set you back in your career. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable career path, but did you take any expeditions during your peak working years, say like maybe in your 40s?
Not anything extensive. I mean, as far as wilderness canoeing, I did a lot of canoeing. I mean, I've canoed all over the world. So we did up through about 36 in age. I was building boats, and then we were racing all over U.S. and Canada, racing Hawaii, New Zealand, Tahiti, Hong Kong, Australia, you know, down in Belize. I did do the Belize trip when I was maybe 20 years ago. So 22 years ago, that was a 200-mile race through the jungle on the two rivers in the Guatemala border across Belize to the ocean.
Wow!
So I did that, and
you were able to do that while you were working full time. Did you?
Yeah, and you know, you just do a lot of training on the water. And of course, that was early in March, so I'm out there on the ice. I scoot my canoe across the ice floe out to the open water below a dam and paddle back and forth in the open water below a dam, just because the only open water we had available up in, because I was right on the northern Michigan and northern Wisconsin border, so there, you know, you don't get a lot of open water that time of year anywhere to paddle. Again, you do whatever you have to make it happen. I've all, you know, mostly all the time kept up with paddling fairly regularly. I mean, I haven't paddled now in 4 days, but we just had the weather turn on us about 4 days ago, and my canoe will be ready. And whenever it's nice, I'll go out again. I don't know if I'll get out this week. I'm leaving Sunday to go away, so I'll be gone for a couple of weeks and then back briefly before I leave again. So I don't imagine I'll get much paddling in for the next month or two or more, month and a half. And then whenever the weather is decent, I'll go out. And it's more enjoyable to get out and bundle up and go out and get the movement and the activity than it is to sit inside on a paddling or rowing machine or something like that. Or, you know, if you get a good day, you know, you go out and just do it. So.
Yeah. Well, Doug, we're over our time. So any parting tips for these people listening who have thought about going on or organizing some sort of expedition? Maybe we talked about some of the ways you saved money, some of the windows of opportunities you took in your life. Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, there's just a lot of people that went through camp that have some of those experiences. And I'm sure any one of them would be more than happy to share experiences and share insights as to how to make things happen. But once you go through, you start getting that whole sense of drive, you know, the whole camp spirit, you know, you'd be amazed how much you just figure out on your own too. And like I say, with today's world, you have so much more information available to you. For getting out to unique places, and it doesn't even have to be that far off to be something unique. It's just something that's new and different to you. I mean, you don't have to, everybody doesn't have to go off to a wilderness place, but I think it's harder and harder to get that remote sense of that feeling of being remote, and the fact that where you're really on your own when you get out to someplace. And those kind of experiences are getting harder and harder to find because encroachment of everything gets into all these wilderness areas, and there's less and less places that are unique and remote. And there's something very special about that remote sensation of being out, being on your own and on your own wits and wisdom are there. And
something you can't get in a city.
Yeah. And that kind of experience is harder and harder to find. But even if you can't do it, there's a certain sense of respect, you know, just that you can take in from watching others' stuff too. I mean, it's watching others that have done that. It's not for everybody, but it's a great experience when you do it, enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
But those places, like I say, they're harder and harder to find. The place where I go up in Canada, the Native people, that land is very much threatened today with mining, mineral extraction, water systems that they want to potentially dam up for electrical power. You know, that's got a massive, massive area up there of watershed system. And you look up in the East Main section of Quebec, Labrador, they dammed, it was the largest hydroelectric system in the world at one point until China beat it out. But there's always that potential that there are people that are interested in doing that with Northern Ontario. And you think this is just a big empty spot of land. Well, that's never the case. You go to any of these empty spots on the maps anywhere in the world, and there are people that live there and probably have been there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so it has an impact on people. And you may think, oh, there's nothing there. But there always is something there. There's people, there's a land form, there's nature that is ever losing its, the boundaries of wilderness areas are getting smaller and smaller all the time. And we're losing that. And it's something that's pretty precious, and you don't want to ever lose that. It's kind of sad to see the continual just encroachment, you know, without real forethought as to what you're doing, what the impact is.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doug, thank you for being here, and hope to catch up again soon.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to visit the camp website, campvoyager.com, to learn more about summer programming, to read blog posts, and to order some gear. Follow Camp on Instagram @camp_voyager. We'll see you next time on the trail.